Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicles Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Moira O'Neill and joining me in the studio today are my colleagues on the Personal Finance team, Leonora Walters and Kate Bealey. And we're also delighted to have two special guests on the show, Lee Robertson, the Chief Executive Officer of wealth management and financial planning firm Investment Quorum, and Alan Higham, Retirement Director at Fidelity Worldwide Investment. Now today we're going to be talking about pension freedoms. From the 6th of April, investors over the age of 55 are going to have complete freedom over how to take money out of their pensions. Unhappiness with annuities was the key trigger for Chancellor George Osborne's announcement a year ago in Budget 2014. And while the new rules are going to give people more choice in retirement, there are plenty of risks to consider alongside all the euphoria. So, Lee, can I start with you? What do you think are the best aspects of the pension freedoms?
Well, I think the word freedom sums it up. I think at long last, people aren't going to have a prescriptive way of withdrawing their retirement savings. They'll be able to take the money as and when they need it, in the form that they want it. And also there are opportunities, if they don't use it during their lifetime, to pass it on.
Alan, do you agree? Do you like the idea of this new pension freedom that's coming in?
Yes, and I think it was essential because retirement isn't you work till 65 and then suddenly stop. Retirement creeps up on people. People go part-time. People retire early, perhaps before their state pension starts. And so this gives an opportunity for people to use the money that's saved in a pension to suit their lifestyle. So somebody retiring, say, at 61 could now draw quite a bit of it out before, say, 65 until their state pension comes in. That flexibility is very welcome and very useful to people.
Is it more difficult to sustain the income over your, say, 20, 30 years in retirement now, though? Because if you're not going to buy a secure, guaranteed income, there are, you know, lots of issues to consider over how much you retire in your early retirement, how much you retire in the middle, and how much you retire at the end.
Well, it's absolutely true that the freedoms aren't a sort of money machine. You don't suddenly have any more money to live on over your retirement. You just have the option to change the emphasis, whether you spend more up front or whether you spend more in the middle, etc. So, yes, the complex decisions about how to make your money last for your whole retirement are still there. Of course, when you bought an annuity, it was a simple issue, but you only got a 6%, say, rate of income each year, which perhaps didn't meet your needs.
Lee, what have you seen among your clients? What kind of questions are they asking about these pension freedoms and what worries do they have?
I think the worries, because we're a financial planning-led firm, I think we talk to clients very deeply about these issues. And I think the big worries they have is they are coming to the realisation that they are living much longer, or they intend to, in general, people living longer. Retiring at 55, that tends not to be our client bank, to be honest. But even if you retire at 65, potentially you've got another 20 or 25 years of retirement income to plan for. So I think these are the big concerns that people have. If they strip too much out at the beginning, if inflation does return to the system, which it probably will somewhere down the line, how quickly will that erode into their capital? So it's quite an interesting dynamic space to be discussing.
I've heard a lot about people might take too much out and pay too big a tax bill and be caught out when they didn't realise how much tax they were going to pay. Do you think that's a genuine concern?
I think it's a huge concern, particularly for those who may not be seeking advice and may wish to do this themselves. I think they haven't realised, or many seem not to have realised yet, that if they take all of the money out as cash, it could tip them up into the next tax bracket in that year, move their higher marginal tax rate. So I think the tax planning is as important as the retirement income planning.
Mm-hmm. Alan, has your research among your customers thrown up any issues that we should be worrying about in relation to pension freedom?
Well, as Lee says, you know, our research shows that around 40% of people approaching retirement now aren't actually aware of the tax position. And also what virtually nobody's aware of is that whilst you are tax liability is at your income tax rates, if you were to make a one-off lump sum withdrawal from your pension in April, your pension provider is actually obliged to tax you using emergency tax principles. So if you wanted to, say, draw out a £15,000 taxable payment from your pension to just to pay for something, and you would be expecting to, say, pay 20% tax, therefore having 12,000 left in your hands, you are going to be disappointed, because your pension provider is going to be required to treat that 15,000 as the first monthly instalment of 12 other ones. So you're going to be taxed as though you have £180,000 worth of income, which will give you a tax rate of around about 37%. That will leave you with quite a significant sum to reclaim from the Inland Revenue.
And it will be up to you to reclaim that money. You're not going to be able to get the tax back automatically at any point.
You can get it back automatically, but you'll have to wait. The Inland Revenue have said at the end of the tax year, they'll do a reconciliation. And if it's clear that you've had too much tax deducted, you'll have that repaid at some point during the next tax year. But I don't think many people want to give an interest-free loan to the taxman over a period of 12 to 18 months. So yes, if you want your tax back straight away, you're going to have to fill out a form, P50 or P53, depending on your circumstance.
Okay. So this will be particularly important for people who are thinking, great, I've just retired and I want to take a lot of money out and really treat myself this first year and go on a cruise or have a special holiday or, I don't know, do it at my conservatory. These tax bills are something to really focus on.
Yeah, and treating yourself is actually the number one objective of people coming up to retirement now. Over 40% of people do plan to treat themselves with some or all of their lump sum element of a particular part of their pension. And knowing exactly what you'll get in your hands is crucial, especially before making any commitments. Don't order the new three-piece suite until you've worked out how much you're going to have left in your hand.
Now, I mean, it's all very nice to treat yourself, but people will also be thinking, I mustn't spend too much because I've got to make it last. Lee, do you have any tips on how you go through that thought process of making your money last over 20, 30 years in retirement?
There's some very basic things you can do, and some of it's just common sense. Never take out more than you actually need. There is a propensity to take out, to round up. So people round up and they take out money they don't actually need. Have a well-diversified portfolio if you're staying invested. Make sure it's designed to generate as tax-efficient an income as possible. So there's lots of things that can be done. But sustainable income going forward is the key to anyone in retirement.
And what kind of levels of income do you think you can get from a portfolio to make it sustainable?
Well, we always talk about a safe yield of 3%. That also leaves some capital growth to counter inflation, to counter charges, because anyone that stays invested in a pension will still be paying charges as well. Mm-hmm. We think that's a relatively decent level to be taking income from. It may sound disappointing to people. They've been quite used to higher yields recently with some of the fixed interest investments, but we think that's a very safe level to build into a plan going forward.
That would leave your capital intact, would it? Taking
we would
3%
certainly hope
out,
so. Yes. Yeah, we would certainly hope so. You can never second guess the markets, and that may have capital issues going forward if we have a market correction. But markets generally over time wander upwards, and if you're looking at a 20 to 25 year investment horizon or timescale in retirement, that should be fine.
I mean, leaving capital intact is one of the things that our readers. Well, many of our readers want to do because they want to pass on assets to their children or grandchildren, and some of the rule changes in the pension freedoms have made it easier to do that. Alan, can you explain what's changed around inheriting?
What's changed is that if you die at any time before age 75, any pension money that's left unspent can be passed on to any beneficiary free of any inheritance tax. If you die after age 75, then any remaining pension fund can be accessed by any beneficiary, and your beneficiary will pay tax at their marginal rate as and when they touch it. Previously, there were restrictions on who could inherit, or if you gave some money to somebody who wasn't your spouse or a dependent as a form of a lump sum, it suffered a 55% tax charge. Now you could leave your pension fund and allow your grandchildren to draw from it using their personal allowance of $10,800 each year, and they could pay no tax. So there's substantial tax savings to be made on inheritance planning with pensions now as a result of the new rules.
I think another point worth making there is that we're largely talking about defined contribution pension plans here, money purchase, personal pensions. Defined benefit schemes, the older style, don't have quite the same freedoms coming forward. And we're seeing clients now who are in those schemes are looking beyond moving out of defined benefit into defined contribution, which is actually a big subject. It's difficult to give up a guaranteed income just for some freedoms down the line, which governments may change in the future anyway. So there are risks involved there.
So those are people who are in what we've also called final salary pension schemes, where the benefits are related to your salary. They don't have access to the new pension freedoms, and they might be thinking of getting a transfer value of their pension and transferring it over into a SIP, that's a self-invested personal pension, where they can access the money freely. Is it a good idea to do that, Alan?
Well, it's very difficult to generalise, and I think you need to start from the point of view that it's probably not the right thing to do for you and look for the exceptions where that is the case. So the areas where I think people should pay most attention to this is people with very large defined benefit pensions, because if their company who sponsored the pension plan was to go insolvent and there wasn't enough money in the pension scheme to pay everybody's benefits, then the people with the biggest pensions get the biggest cutbacks. So you are more at risk if your company does happen to go bust, like Woolworths did. You know, many household names it has happened to. And as Lee said, you know, you could be 25, 30 years in retirement. So you perhaps don't want to take that risk. Other situations where it might pay is if you're in very poor health. So the guaranteed income for life, as Lee says, it's a great thing. You wouldn't want to give it up easily. But if your life not expected to be that long, actually taking the transfer value could be in your interest.
Right. Now, the sort of investments that people might be considering when they, because they can take a lot of their pension money out of their pension pot, one of these investments that people are looking at is buy-to-let. So you can take a massive sum out of your pension and use it to generate an income through property. Lee, what are your thoughts on that as an investment option?
Yeah, I'd probably start even before I get there, just saying that I have a big fear right now that there is a lot of pension money up for grabs, and unscrupulous people will be after that money. So people have got to be incredibly careful about the things they invest in, and they should look at ScamSmart on the regulator's website. They should look at PensionWise. Going through to buy-to-let as an asset class, we don't advise on property. I understand it's done particularly well. Properties, particularly in the southeast, has raced forward and shows no real sign of abating. So I'm sure people will be very, very tempted by it. People like things they can touch, bricks and mortar. They've had experience themselves. They've had their own property. There's that whole thing of if I buy it, I can put a child in it while they're at university, then I can let it out, etc. So I think it will be attractive, but just beware if you're taking big lump sums out to go into buy-to-let property, you're going to be suffering quite a big tax charge on the way out. That will affect your yield going forward, at least for a while. So I understand the attractions. I personally would rather have a more diversified portfolio.
Alan, do you agree with Lee on the risks of buy-to-let?
Yes, I do. And actually, when we look at our research, we've surveyed 500 people who are about to retire in the next 12 months. It's only a tiny minority that actually plan to use some of their lump sum to go into buy-to-let. It's perhaps only 4% of those people. So we're not seeing it as a big driver. Obviously, it's probably more attractive to people with defined benefit pensions who've got large incomes that's quite secure. They think that will be enough for me to meet all my essential expenses. So my tax-free lump sum, if I'm getting, say, £150,000 worth of tax-free cash from that, they might well look to put that into a property because they feel more comfortable with property. But it is only a tiny minority of people are doing it. And my advice to anybody listening is just make sure you've covered all your essential expenses with secure income. If you have, then you can afford to invest more freely. Buy to let, by all means. But remember, you've got a lot tied up in property in your residential house as well. You never want too much in any one asset class.
If you're going to secure an income, you're probably going to end up back looking at an annuity, which is what the pension freedoms are really trying to avoid, you know, people buying. Is there still a place for annuities, Lee?
I believe there is. Mm-hmm. I think it's often in the way of the telling. If I were to say to a client, without describing the annuity, if I said, if I could give you a guaranteed secure income from the rest of your life and give you no market risk worry, what do you think? Typically, they would say, yes, I rather fancy that. And then you say it's an annuity, and they go, oh, no, I don't want an annuity. I don't like those. And I think they've suffered a bit from, obviously, very low interest rates. So people have come to not like them. They've had a bit of a pretty tough time in the press as well. But if you're looking for secure income, then there is a place for them. Particularly, as Alan said earlier, if there's impaired health, you get a better rate. So I think at least for a part of your income, they may make sense. The other thing, of course, if you cover all your basic expenses with an annuity, it allows you more freedom to take a slightly more adventurous, shall we say, investment approach, which you will need for a 20 to 25 year retirement.
Yeah, so you won't be worrying as much about the actual fluctuations in the market with a big portion of your pension if you've got that secure income that covers the basics. Is that right, Alan?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, if you've covered essential expenses with secure income from your state pension, from any final salary pension, and from an annuity if necessary, then that gives you much more freedom. People reaching state pension age before April 2016, though, can make use of an alternative way of having a secure income, and that's to rely more on the state. If you don't take your state pension when you're first eligible and defer taking it, it increases at a fantastic rate of 10.4%. You could spend more of your private pension money up front instead of using it to buy an annuity and get much more from the state than you would be able to buy from an insurance company. It can give you more than double the annuity that you could buy on the open market. So that's an option for people reaching state pension age before 6th of April 2016.
That's a great tip. Well, thanks very much, guys, for all of your tips today. That's really interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In this week's magazine, personal finance writer Kate Bearley has been looking in detail at investing in the US. Now, Kate, why is everyone talking about the US at the moment?
And well, there's been an enormous amount of discussion around the latest two-day meeting of the Federal Reserve, and in particular around whether or not it was going to drop the word patient from its forward guidance statement in relation to interest rates. Enormous amount of obsession over this word, and in fact, it did drop the word patient. Which led people to think that it will be raising rates from zero, where they've been since the financial crisis. So that means that from June, the Fed's going to be making the decision kind of meeting by meeting, rather than pledging to keep rates low for a really long time. And it's kind of a big deal, because the US has been on the path to recovery for a while, ever since the crisis. And it looks like this could be a signal that it's finally emerged. The end of quantitative easing happened last year, but then things like wage growth have been a bit slower, and the strength of the dollar has had a bit of an impact as well.
So you've been canvassing the views of a few fund managers, haven't you? Now, how have they been reacting? What's their experiences?
Well, I mean, the US has typically not been a good place for active managers, and I think they would all hold their hands up to that. They've kind of notoriously failed to outperform the benchmark, and last year was a really tough year for all of them, and I think a lot of money has kind of flooded into cheaper passive funds as a result. A lot of managers said that with rates being so low, investors were kind of pushed into or more interested in dividend-paying defensive stocks, which hasn't helped those managers more focused on the kind of value-orientated smaller companies. So a lot of them said they've, you know, struggled last year, and it was quite a difficult time. There's also a bit of infighting among active managers, saying that a lot of them were kind of hugging the benchmark and there wasn't quite enough, you know, individual thinking. But in terms of how some of those macro trends have impacted funds, the dollar and the strength of the dollar has really hit some of them. So, for example, UBS Equity Fund spoke to Tom Diggenen, who said that the strength of the dollar impacted on food brand Yum and confectionery company Mondelez because of revenue generated outside the US being impacted. And also the oil price fall has hit some companies which managers held. So there were a few kind of headwinds that were slightly unpredictable and really impacted on them.
Okay, so they've been making a lot of excuses for performance, but how are they going to turn it around? Where are they seeing value this year?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the thing to say is that they're all, you know, they all say their time is coming, really, and that this year and from now onwards will be the time for active managers to shine as rates rise and investors are slightly more interested in maybe looking for some value opportunities. So they've all got quite different views on where that value will come from. So, for example, Tom Diggenen, he really likes banks, which, you know, might surprise some people. But his view is that regulatory scares have made them better value. And actually, a lot of banks have really deleveraged, making them a better option.
We expect an active manager to try and be contrarian, but yes, in that sense. So, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And then the oil price falls has presented interesting opportunities, both for companies whose share prices crashed and might come back up, but some other kind of interesting trends in terms of things like car retailing, which is a massive market for the US. Quite a few managers were talking about that. So, for example, Mark Sherlock at Hermes, US SMID Equity Fund, he likes a car supermarket called CarMax, because a lot of managers said that actually this is a really good area for value, and the major players have quite a small market share, so there's a lot of potential for growth, and there is the potential that with petrol prices coming down, maybe people will spend that excess on a new car. So some interesting ideas coming out, I think.
So to read more about all of those views and for our ideas on how to invest a portion of your portfolio in US funds, you can read those in this week's Investors Chronicle. Now, on other investment areas, Deputy Personal Finance Editor Leonora Walters has been looking at the Alliance Trust saga that's unfolding. Now, this is a big global investment trust that a lot of investors may hold. Leonora, can you tell us what's happening? There's an activist shareholder, I believe.
Yes, one of the largest shareholders in Alliance Trust, Elliott Advisors, wants to add 3 new directors to the board because they're unhappy about a number of things. Alliance Trust rejects the idea and is telling its shareholders to vote against the suggestion at the AGM on the 29th of April. Since Elliott initially made the requisition on the 16th of March, the two have entered a war of words and they seem to be filing claim and counterclaim against each other day in, day out. But to summarise, Elliott has a number of grievances, which some other people share. I mean, they point out to underperformance of Alliance Trust against sector peers and benchmarks, which is true. It hasn't done the best. They also complain about the high and inflexible nature of a trust's internal investment management function. And they also don't like the fact there's losses in 2 of the subsidiaries, Alliance Trust Savings and Alliance Trust Investments. Those are the 3 main things. Other things they kind of pick up on are the discount to net asset value, which is obviously a result of a poor performance. And they're also not happy about internal appointments without consultation of shareholders. Alliance Trust appointed a new head of equities in autumn last year, and they didn't consult shareholders. Elliott would actually like the management to be outsourced because they think an external manager could do it more cheaply and offer better performance. In their words, they say the board would benefit from added expertise, experience and a fresh perspective. The people they've lined up are like former financial services people, Anthony Brook, Peter Chambers, who actually used to be the chief executive officer of Legal and General Investment Management, and Rory McNamara. So all quite experienced individuals. Alliance Trust really takes objection to this and says shareholders should vote against it because it argues that the directors aren't independent because they've been put up by Elliott. Now, what Elliott says is it paid a search firm, it didn't get the directors themselves and it didn't know the directors, therefore they are independent because the search firm found them. Alliance Trust says because Elliott paid the search firm, the directors aren't independent. So that's one of the bones of contention.
And apparently it's not just Elliott and Alliance Trust who are having discussion. We've got another body, a shareholder body, who's weighed into the debate, yeah, and given some advice to shareholders of Alliance Trust.
Yeah, I mean, ShareSoc, I mean, they're a private shareholder representative organisation, and they put out a statement kind of backing Elliott's actions because, again, they feel that poor performance, wide discount to NAVs aren't good.
And there is an annual general meeting coming up, isn't there?
Yeah, the 29th of April, when people get to vote on the issue. And, Alliance Trust doesn't want shareholders to back this action. I mean, it also thinks Elliott's like a short-termist hedge fund out to get a quick profit and leave everybody high and dry. And apparently Elliott has suggested a 40% tender for shares as a way to narrow the discount. Alliance Trust says that would involve selling off a lot of good assets. Elliott says it's not a short-term shareholder, it's a long-term shareholder, it's held the shares for 5 years, and its solution, putting directors on, is not short-termist. So the debate weighs on.
Exactly.
The
debate will probably continue and we shall report on it.
Until the 29th of April, yeah.
Now, Leonora, you've also this week looked at another investment trust, BlackRock World Mining. Now, this trust underperformed in 2014. Why was that?
Yeah, the trust had a pretty bad year. Its net asset value fell 26.4%. Share price fell 30%, whereas the Euromoney Global Mining Index only went down 13%. And the reason for this is the investment trust's holdings of non-equity investments. Now, mining funds and mining investment trusts typically buy the shares of mining companies. But in 2012, BlackRock started to invest in royalties from mines. The reason it did that was to boost its income, because it adopts a new high income policy. And the trust's board says that buying royalties allows it to participate in long-term production revenues and resource growth, and diversifies the trust's source of revenue, so it's not just relying on dividends. Now, unfortunately, in October, it had to write down one of the royalties from the Mirampa mine, as well as a convertible bond, both issued by iron ore producer London Mining. London Mining couldn't meet its financial obligations because of a fall in the iron price, slower than expected ramp-up of a second plant, and the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone, where the mine is based. So they've written down the value of that to zero. BlackRock also reduced the valuation of some gold-linked preference shares and a corporate bond issued by Banro, where this has had less of an impact. So what they thought was going to be, you know, a really good source of income in two out of three cases has turned out quite badly. They still have the option of buying another royalty, so that they may include that. And they haven't ruled out investing in more royalties, but what they have done is tightened up the guidelines for what they can include. I think as a result of that, you know, it's poor performance, things gone slightly awry. One of the managers, Catherine Raw, left. Now, BlackRock says it's to take up a corporate position within the mining sector. But, you know, obviously, you know, well, I suppose it was, she wasn't leaving things in a good shape. I don't know. The new manager is going to be Olivia Markham, and she's also co-manager of BlackRock Commodities Income Investment Trust. Evie Hambo, who's, I think, the main manager on BlackRock World Mining, he continues on in the position. So it was a bit of a changeover. Analysts aren't very concerned because they feel, you know, it was very much a team approach BlackRock taken. Evie Hambo's still there.
So you can read more about BlackRock World Mining in the magazine. Now, in the Your Money section this week, we've been looking at a little part of the budget notes that wasn't flagged very widely, and that's something called deeds of variation. Now, the Chancellor was looking at scrapping the ability to vary your will after you died. And Kate, you've been looking at the implications of this. Now, what is a deed of variation? Can you explain that?
Well, deeds of variation enable beneficiaries of a will to amend that will after death, as long as all the beneficiaries agree and the changes are made within 2 years if those changes have tax implications.
And why is it used? Is it for tax planning purposes?
Yeah, and most commonly seems to be used to pass an estate to your children, for example, if you receive the estate but you don't have need for it and you want that to go to your children, you can amend it so that it goes directly there and you don't, you know, both sets of people don't have to pay inheritance tax. Although it's also used if a will has maybe left people out or the beneficiaries feel that it's unfair.
What exactly is the Chancellor planning to do in relation to this little loophole that people use?
Well, I mean, it's unclear. In the budget, he announced it partly as a bit of a swipe to Ed Miliband, potentially, who has used this with his own family. But he just said that he'd be reviewing the use of deeds of variation for tax purposes as a part of his wider intention to clamp down on tax avoidance. I mean, it's important to note that he didn't say he would definitely be scrapping it, and with such uncertainty over the election, who knows whether, you know, the review will go ahead and who will even be in power to look at it.
But if you've had a family member and sadly die recently and they left substantial assets and you might have been thinking of using this form of tax planning, should you get a move on, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to think about things you could do now just in case. And one of those things is, if you were thinking about amending a will, you know, you've got 2 years, but you might as well do it now, just in case they are scrapped. And also, everybody has to agree on this change. So it could, you know, involve a bit of negotiation among your family. Might as well get moving now. But the best thing for everyone is to just make sure your will is up to date so that there's no need to amend it anyway. So have these conversations with your families and, you know, make sure it's not just in a drawer somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people will be keeping it in a drawer for years and not looking at it. So yeah, Now's the time to get it out and check it's what you really want.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thank you very much to my special guests, Lee Robertson of Investment Quorum and Alan Higham of Fidelity, and to Leonora Walters and Kate Bealey of the Investors Chronicle. You can read more about the new pension freedoms in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle. Thank you for listening.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.